Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of SaaS Boss Show. Today, I am excited to interview Gonzalo Silva, and Gonzalo is obsessed with building the future he wants to work in, where location is irrelevant to being part of a highly productive team. That's why he joined Doist almost a decade ago, and this is why he remains there today as their CTO, building tools like Todoist and Twist that help over 25 million people combined worldwide to be productive and live a more fulfilling life. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Natalie. Nice to be here.
Tell us, how did you get started with Doist?
Well, actually, Doist is a very accidental, you know, happy event for me. I was a freelancer at the time. And Doist was a client. I just had such an amazing time. The company was just starting. The founder was practically working alone at the time. That when he started scaling the company, he reached out to me and said, hey, so would you be open to joining? And I said, yeah, why not? It was one of the very best clients I've ever had. So that's how it all started. That's how I started working with Doist remotely from the start. I was a developer at the time. As the company grew, we started needing things like team leaders. And that's when I became a team leader. And later on, with scale, we had multiple teams. We needed some strategy, direction, and honestly, a bit of glue between the team. So then I became CTO. This was about 4 years ago. I'm a software engineer. So I'm a programmer at heart, actually. I still very much enjoy programming, although nowadays, most of what I do is leadership or management related.
Tell us a little bit about the company.
So Doist is a fully distributed company. So we're fully remote. We've always been. The company is now over 10 years old, actually. It all started as a side project of the founder back in 2007. Amir was in college and he was also juggling side jobs. And he needed a productivity tool to get organized. He wasn't happy with whatever else was in the market. So he kind of like just built it himself. And then friends and other people that saw him using his own tool were excited, like, have you considered, you know, turning this into a product? And that's kind of like how it all started. So for about 3 years, Todoist was a side project just like this. Eventually, it started generating enough revenue to pay for the founder's salary, which is when he started focusing exclusively on it. And about a year later, he started like employing freelancers to do specific work. For example, I came in to build the Android app. And when revenue started becoming more stable, he started hiring permanent people like employees and teams. And that's how I joined. Eventually, we realized we had very, I guess, strong ideas of how to build an organization nowadays. That's why we're fully remote. That's why we so strongly advocate for things like asynchronous communication. We're so avidly against micromanagement and so strongly fond of empowering people and trusting them. And we kind of like built our brand around this too. And this is who we are. This is our, you know, our corner in the market.
Help us frame the conversation a little bit. What it is that we're going to talk about today?
So I think, you know, from a lot of the episodes I've heard from the podcast, something that might be useful for the audience would be talking a bit about building culture, right? So us being bootstrapped, being fully remote, like all of the things I mentioned before, we have to rely a lot on the culture we build and be conscious about the way we build it. Because first of all, I mentioned empowering people, trusting people. This is exactly what we do. And a lot of the things we design, the way we design our organization and the way we work are settled upon independence, autonomy, and ownership from everybody. But for this to work well, we need, for example, to define the fundamentals, right? So something that everybody at Doist knows are our core values. And we know some other companies have core values too, but ours, I would say, are a bit different. So for example, we only have 5. And we trimmed that down from 12, I think, originally down to 5, because we want all of us to be able to know this by heart at the tip of our tongues. So we really wanted to bring this down, and we try to employ these core values in everything, all the work that we do and the way we do it. So having these core values set in stone across all of the organization, and also making it very clear what's our long-term direction and identity, then we are free to empower people to solve the challenges at hand and not have to micromanage, not have to, you know, focus too much on how the work is being done, and focus more on the results and letting people own the work that they do. So this empowerment is very important, I would say, in all scenarios, but especially in remote, because luckily, thankfully, micromanagement is not a viable option. Another thing we have to be conscious about is modeling the behavior we want to see. So, you know, if you have all of these rules, all of these core values, all of this identity that you're developing and that you're documenting, but then you don't actually practice it on a day-to-day basis, that's going to send, you know, very wrong signals. So something that I would highly recommend people starting out companies is being conscious about the message they're sending, how they are perceived by others. They should be embedding the core values that they preach. That is super, super important long-term. Something else that works really well for us too is transparency and documentation. So we're actually not alone in this. There are other companies like Buffer and GitLab who are very transparent about everything. We try to keep the things we do very transparent, even on a leadership level. For example, we don't have that many private channels, if we have them at all. We don't have that many private discussions. Of course, we don't want to overwhelm people. We don't want them to notify, we don't want to notify everybody about every discussion, but we try to make everything open. So if you're curious, if you need this information, if you want a specific information, you can search for it, you can find it. And we also document a lot of these things so that that also helps, you know, with transparency. Because if I have a meeting with somebody and we make a decision, if we don't document it in a remote setting, this is almost like it not happening, right? Other people don't know about it. Other people can't refer back to it. So documenting the things as they happen is a great tool to make sure that things are transparent across the board. And lastly, and I guess this is one of the highest level points, is about incentives. This correlates a little bit with modeling the behavior you want to see. It's being aware of the incentives that are in place, right? Like, we are very driven around the incentives there are, and some of them can be indirect. For example, if you are very strict about a specific work schedule, the incentive you are creating is for people to arrive and leave at specific times. Not necessarily that they are very productive or that they're proud of the work they're doing. You're creating an incentive around the schedule. When you empower people to solve problems, generally speaking, you are, you know, the incentive is for them to really leverage their strengths and pour, you know, the things they're good at and the things they believe in the work that they do. And this comes with trust. And so it's always, always important to be aware of the incentives that are in place. And for example, I see this sometimes with learning. A lot of organizations explore ways to encourage learning within their teams. And then sometimes they have things like having people share their favorite book every month. This might not be the best incentive for people to learn, and depending on how you model this. So for example, if you have a book club where people read and they discuss the book together and they go over the lessons and all of that, that's, you know, great. I think that really creates a momentum for people to read more, to learn more. But if you're just a checklist type of behavior of, you know, last month I read book A or B or C, you're not necessarily creating an incentive to learn. You're creating an incentive to, you know, open a book, maybe skim it, and then close the book and share it on the next update. So this is just a very specific example, but incentives are all around us, and we have to be conscious of how we design them within our organizations.
Very interesting. That was one of my initial questions. You did not have management experience before, so you probably learned all of this on the job, right? So this was an iterative process where, for sure, you've made all kind of mistakes, right? So it is a process, like an evolution, right? So how did you come up with all of your processes? Because I'm pretty sure, like, share all the bad side of that as well, because I'm pretty sure you've made all possible mistakes, and that's how you learn on that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were a lot of things we had to learn on the fly. I think also thinking we know is one of the most dangerous things to do. So an example, for example, for people with technical or design backgrounds that I think happened to me originally was I came from a very strong technical background and I had very strong ideas about how to do things. So at first, I think I was maybe too strongly advocating for specific ways of solving problems, right? While it's probably much more interesting to empower people to solve problems in the way they see fit, because ultimately they are going to be the ones constantly investing into these problems and improving things. So it's maybe more important to support people than it is to, you know, make sure they're doing the thing you think is right. I was going to say the right thing, but that's actually the wrong way to look at it. It's the way you think is right. And a lot of these, I definitely made a lot of these mistakes. We have all had at Doist, but I also think we have a very inclusive and transparent culture. So as I was saying before around transparency, we embrace candor quite a bit. So when things are off, we generally speak up about them. This is really helpful in course correcting and also improving things before we drain our trust batteries, right? So something that I'm very grateful for and that I also recommend people do within their organizations is fostering a culture of feedback so that you can improve very quickly based on what people tell you and how they perceive you doing your job. But yeah, definitely, there have been a lot of mistakes. I knew nothing about managing people. Later on, I knew nothing about managing managers. They are all very different. Again, I thought they were similar. They're not. Another wrong assumption. But again, like just taking a lot of feedback in and trying to act on it, you know, making a plan of improvement around this and being constantly growing, I think it's a great recipe to grow as an individual, as a leader, as a manager.
How many people on the team right now?
We're about 80 people. On the engineering team, which is closer to the work that I do, we're about 40 people.
I had no idea. All right. So how many of those are developers versus other departments, marketing versus the middle layer management?
Yeah, that's it. Like the development team, there's about 40 people. And in total, we're 6 managers. So there's me and there's like 5 engineering managers managing these 40 people. The rest of the company, it's around, you know, 40 more people. Our marketing team has roughly 10 people, although they are very specialized within departments. So we have people working on content. We have people working on, you know, product marketing. We have people working on growth and all of that. But it's around 10 people in total.
Let's talk a little bit about hiring and then later onboarding. So let's start with hiring. So how do you find those people? How do you interview those people and kind of get a feeling whether they are going to be a good fit versus a bad fit for your company?
So I think the way we hire is very, so we don't go after people very often. So we generally put out a job posting, we promote it on social media and all of our channels, and we wait for people to come to us. I will be upfront. This didn't work very well in our first few years. And I remember we had a lot of conversations about how we were not having enough leads, how we didn't feel like the leads were exactly, you know, the leads that we wanted to have. And to be totally honest with you, I don't think we ever solved this problem. We just became large enough so that now we have, you know, enough traction whenever we put a job posting out. So we don't feel this problem anymore. But generally speaking, the way we interview is we have 3 interviews. They are, most of them are focused on value add and culture, basically. Like, are you aligned with the way we, you know, with the way we work? Like, for example, if we're hiring a manager and this person is very keen on micromanagement, for example, this is kind of like a filter we use. And even for the technical tasks, and when I mean technical, it's not only about engineering. So for all of our positions, we have a test project that is related with the work you do on a day-to-day basis. And even this is very different from the regular test, which is generally real-time, things like coding on a whiteboard, right? Like, we don't do any of this. We try to find test projects that mirror the work that the people do on a day-to-day basis. For example, for a developer, that could be, you know, here's a repository with some code. We need you to do a code review. We need you to implement a small feature. We need to, you know, fix a bug that comes from support. And we exercise all of these muscles that we use on a day-to-day basis, like communication, attention to detail, technical quality for sure. But even this is done on their own terms. So these projects are modeled around 8 to 12 hours and people just take them home and do whenever they want. We generally don't use deadlines at all. And if we do, it's like in the 2 or 3, 4 weeks window span. So there's a lot of time for people to kind of like sit down and focus on the project. We try to focus on the values and things that drive people on the interview side. And on the test side, we try to focus on the actual day-to-day kind of work and the things that are really important when we're doing our work on a day-in, day-out basis.
And when they perform those test assignments, do you pay them for their time, or are those expected to be free?
No. These projects are paid. They have been paid since we were very small. I mean, of course, when we were very small, the payments were not very large, but they existed. So we were compensating people for their time from the get-go. We don't really want people to work for free. We don't believe in that, and we don't want to support that.
Can you share with us some tips and tricks for your onboarding process? Maybe some things that you know worked or didn't work for you in the past? Because I think this is like 90% of success of people that we hire. Because if they are not onboarding properly, I'm pretty sure that we are just not setting up for success. And there's just so many things that come from this poor versus good onboarding.
So onboarding, I think it's super critical to have a plan. And sometimes we don't have a proper plan. Like, we need a plan. For example, when you're onboarding a new person, they should probably have a mentor. Like, they should have a support system from the get-go that helps them feel at home, that kind of like creates a bridge immediately for them to clarify any doubts and to start feeling like part of the team. I also think it's very critical that you plan their first few tasks. So for example, for us, we have a Todoist project with things ranging from, you know, introduce yourself on Twist, which is our communication tool, and tell 10 interesting facts about yourself, to things like connect with 2 random people in the company, whoever you want, to have a quick chat, to more tactical tasks like, you know, review our core values in this document. These things are, I think, super important because they create momentum for the person, and they set them up for success. So ideally, later on, they won't have to be searching for information, or they won't be lost in what they need to do, right? These are general things, the things I described, but then they belong to a specific team usually, you know, be it the marketing team, a development team, for example. It's also important to design their first few projects successfully. So for example, you want people to create value as soon as possible, because this ultimately, this is what they're in for. And it's a great way to bond to the project itself. For development teams, for example, we aim to have people ship software to actual users very, very quickly. But you also need to balance complexity, right? You don't want people to come in and tackle your most difficult project from day one. So there's some design to be done here. And also something that we have learned, and this is another thing we weren't great all the time, is that feedback loops are very important. So you should be very explicit about the way you provide feedback to people and how often. We struggled with this a bit early on because, you know, sometimes we were not fully transparent, or we were counting on things to change. You know, when things weren't going well, we were thinking, maybe next week will be better. This is a red flag. It's a mistake. If you feel like something is not right, you should be talking to the person. You owe it to them, even out of respect and out of respect for the person and the role you are hiring to. Being transparent about how things are going, where the expectations are, and how well you perceive them doing is super important, and not something I think is well done all of the time. Feedback loops, I think are the most important thing.
I wanted to point out the 2 things that you mentioned is, when there is a problem, do not wait a few weeks to share this information with the person. You owe it to them to set them up for success. And if something is not being done to, you know, the way that you expected it, maybe, then communicate this immediately, right away. I know how hard it is. When I first became a manager, it was so hard for me to, because, you know, you're sharing with the person that, you know, something negative, right? So you feel bad about this. So step over that, you owe it to that person. I love that idea, number one. And number two, you also mentioned about the first projects and small tests need to also be something that helps people get a small win right away, right? So that it's not like a long, boring, very detailed project, but something that's going to be relatively quick for them to get this excitement. Like, yes, I can do this. Everything's going good. Because everyone's pretty nervous, especially in the beginning, right? So those 2 things I wanted to point out. So now that we're talking about onboarding, it looks like maybe there are a few more things that you didn't mention, but from our standpoint, and this is also came from our previous experience and all the fails and problems that we had in the past with our previous employees, But there are a few things that we have in place when we're onboarding people. So you have your core five values. We also have company values. They are not core five, but more like what it is that we, what we expect from people, from like the behaviors. So for example, like you mentioned at the beginning, not asynchronous communication because everyone's like around the world, right? Do not have one-on-one communication if you talk about a project that can be applicable to many people. So you speak about this particular project, you know, in the channel that is appropriate for that particular project so that everyone is aware and you don't need to do multiple one-on-one conversations, right? If you've made a mistake, do not try to hide this mistake. So we have this open communication. I think this is something that you also mentioned. So all of those things, we probably have a dozen or something. Those are not our core values, but this is like how we want to behave, how we want them to behave and what we appreciate in the employees. So all of those things that you can think about, put them in those values so that later when you do have some problems or someone does not perform the best way or does not pay attention to details or something like that, you can go back to this list of values and you can point it out and say, hey, it's not like you're a bad person, but we expect that this is how it needs to be done, right? You remember that we would like to be this way. So this is a great way to help you in the communicating those problems with the person. And then you mentioned how to have a small plan. We actually found out, we recently onboarded a support person, and we found that having at least one, preferably 2 week plan where we outline that step by step. Day one, this is what you will do. Day two, this is what you will do. So that it's not micromanaging, but it's more like, and probably it's only 20% of the person's time. So right, maybe this is project for like 1 or 2 hours a day, and then the rest the person can still deal with whatever's on their plate. So having this plan at least for 1 week, preferably 2 weeks, what it is that you expect from them is very important. Another thing is expectations, KPIs, and goals. I recently spoke to a founder who said that they hired a BDR person, business development person, who, and they did not have goals. They had a goal like, I want to have one sale every month. But that's the end goal that is so hard to achieve if you don't specify what it is that the person is expected to do, right? So the leading indicator, like you need to make 10 calls a day, because, you know, reverse engineering your math and saying that out of 100 calls, we can expect one sale, for example, right? 100 calls, you speak to 10 people, and then out of 10 people, you can expect one sale. So this reverse engineering and explaining the goals, what it is that you expect the person to do within, you know, this time frame. For example, every day I expect you to do 20 calls, and this is how you're going to achieve your goal. So this SaaS founder did not have those specific goals outlined. And so within 3 weeks, they had to let this person go because there was no way that they could get back on the same page.
Yeah, that's the thing about setting expectations. And it starts with hiring. I mentioned screening for values in hiring because when I talk about the core values, for example, these are the non-negotiables for us, right? Like these five things, they are the non-negotiable for us. So of course, we even put them on the job ad. Because if you're thinking about applying to Doist, but you read this and think, I really don't fit in here, we want you to be able to do this exercise yourself. And sometimes that happens. But ultimately, the key here is aligning expectations. So the new people coming in, like everybody in the company needs to know what's expected of them from the CEO down to the last person you hired last week. They need to know what's expected of them. And the feedback loops need to be very tight because ultimately, we're all collaborating together, right? We're all communicating together. And when we feel that our expectations are not met or when we're frustrated, the key here is any delays in communicating this will only make things worse. Like it's very, very rare that problems go away by themselves. So it's, and even if they do, if they come back later and you haven't said anything, it will be new to the person, but not new for you. So even then you're kind of like contributing to this misalignment. So I think all of the things you do when you onboard somebody need to be very, you know, you need to be very conscious about aligning these expectations and being transparent about them. And something you mentioned about the first week plan, we totally agree with this. And I would even go further. Our onboarding is actually something kind of a process that lasts 3 months, generally speaking, where we are very granular about the first week, then we're not granular at all, but we still think about the first three projects. It's kind of like a project per month for most people, and we think about the first three projects you're going to be working on. And they are designed intentionally to give you know-how in the critical things for the job, to build up confidence, to let you also experience collaboration with different people and feel integrated within the team. And we even have this process after the 3 months where we're very explicit. There is a milestone there where you either stay in the team or you don't stay in the team, depending on the criteria. And that's another reason why the feedback loops are so important. So honestly, most people stay in the team. We have don't have many examples of this not happening. But in the cases where it doesn't happen, it should never come as a surprise for the person, right? Because they felt that things were not going well. They got this feedback. They got opportunities to improve. They got actionable feedback back. So it really just wasn't working out. And we wouldn't be doing anybody a favor, even the person, maybe they could be happier working in a different team, in a different field, in a different company. So we're just very explicit about all of these things. And I really recommend doing this because it makes everything easier for everybody, not just you. I understand it's harder, like you need to embrace conflict a little bit if you're going to deliver negative feedback to somebody. But that's the thing. If you wait a month of frustration, then you're going to be at a tipping point. And if you let the person know earlier on, maybe they would have been able to course correct. You would be much less frustrated. Maybe it wouldn't have been a problem at all. So you could have avoided this problem if you provided feedback early on. So definitely being very transparent about expectations and talking as soon as things pop up.
We have a lot of new founders listening to this podcast. Founders who probably have not made any hires. Maybe they've made one and then they are not satisfied with how it went, and then possibly they're back being by themselves. What are some step-by-step guidance that you would recommend that they need to keep in mind when making this first or second or third hire to set up those people for success?
So the first few hires I think are critical. It really helps if you hire people who are kind of like entrepreneurs like yourself, or they act like an owner. And ideally, and this is pure observation, I might be totally off here, but I've seen a lot of success cases where the first person coming in, the second person coming in, they take things off your plate that you don't like doing, that you're not good at doing. For example, our first hire was a support person. Amir was an engineer. He was handling, he was building the product. He was doing the design even. But the thing he really disliked the most was just like the stream of emails with customers and back and forth, because what he wanted mostly was to have a summary of the problems so that he could go back to focused work, to coding. So his first hire was a support person to handle this side of the business, which made things very efficient. Another thing I think it's very important, and I see a lot of early companies, early founders struggling with is, just saying no to almost everything, even basic things like focus and prioritization are crucial. There should only be a handful of things you're focusing on, and you should try to do them very, very, very well. And just say no to everything else. Like, of course, I have a technical background, so it's easier for me to speak on technical terms, but a lot of things about this early technology were really bad. They were really bad. But if they weren't bad, it means we would have spent a lot of time making them good, and maybe we wouldn't have gotten the business off the ground. They're good now. After 10 years, we've had chance to improve a lot of things, but this prioritization was very, very important in the beginning. There's this framework that I use personally, which I call LNO. So it's kind of like looking at the things you need to do and classifying them in either L, which stands for leverage. It's like things that give you leverage in your work, in your business. I also call it the 10X. The N, which is the neutral, those are the 1X things like, that they don't give you leverage, but they need to get done. And the O, which is the overhead. This is the 0x. Like most of your emails, you need to kind of like, you won't leave them there, but they're there and they occupy time. And the cool thing about LNO is that you should be putting a lot of focus on the L things, on the things that give you leverage. You should really do the best job you can on them and then just rush through the N things. And if you can, automate or ditch all of the O things. This is a personal framework, but this really works also for early companies. What are the things that give you leverage? Be very explicit about those, figure them out, and then double down on them, saying no to almost everything else. Like, I don't want to be too strict about this, but another thing that I see, for example, is when you think about the structure of your company and things like this, like getting things off the ground should be your priority. Like if you're selling a product, it should be building the product. So spending a lot of time early on designing an organization that will scale towards 100 employees and having amazing processes, like I would just say, you know, throw that all of that out the window. Leverage the fact that you don't have a lot of people, you don't need a lot of process, you can iterate really fast and focus on the things that matter. This ruthless focus and leveraging being small, it's a huge advantage if played right.
Got it. Any last parting words?
I think that covers all of what I wanted to say. Ultimately, I think parting advice is for founders, you know, you're building your own business, you're kind of like, it's like your baby, right? And it might be very hard when you hire your first team and you start hiring to let that go and empower other people to do things. But I think it's a very necessary step to build your legacy, being able to trust and empower other people, because ultimately things won't scale with just you doing things or deciding on things. So the sooner you embrace this process of leveraging the good things about collaboration and empowering other people, the more I think successful you will be in building that initial team and scaling out of the 1, 2, 3 people phase.
Sounds good. Where can people find you and if they want to connect with you?
Well, I'm not very strong on social media, but I do use Twitter. So I have a LinkedIn account too, but I don't really go there. So if you want to connect with me, I'm generally active on Twitter. I share things I like and I will gladly engage in any conversation you want.
Absolutely. Sounds good. Oh, thank you so much for all this time.
Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. This is one of my favorite subjects, by the way. So this has been great to be able to chat with you and talk soon.